31. 2:30 a.m., November 15, 2018. Gittinger Condominiums, Chicago, Illinois. Matilda slept through the first three rings as her cell danced on her nightstand. At the fourth, eyes still closed, she reached over, picked up her cell, and pressed it to her ear.
Hello?
The phone was cold. Matilda was under three layers of blankets and wore flannels. Her fabric cocoon. Curled fetal, she wasn't sweating. She'd had a boyfriend in college, Oscar, who used to call her a caddisfly. He specifically meant the larval form of the caddisfly, a small, grub-like insect, found in fast-running cold water creeks and rivers. The creature built a little house for itself out of pebbles, a sort of rocky blanket that it hides in, before it's old enough to molt and take skyward. Despite the subtle gross-out factor, or maybe because of it, Matilda liked the nickname. And she liked that he thought the insects were cute, snug in their stony burritos. After their relationship soured, and it really did, badly, she kept the nickname.
Dr. Deacon, this is Detective Omobo. Sorry to wake you.
What time is it?
A little after 2:30. I wanted to talk to you about the girl.
Ashanique? Thought you wanted to wait until tomorrow morning.
Matilda sat up in her bed, suddenly very awake and concerned. Her bedroom ceiling was crisscrossed with lines of light, reflecting off the snow and ice on the street, two floors below. On the wall opposite her bed, she saw a warped version of her pale face reflected in the television screen. She looked tiny, alone.
Is she okay? Matilda asked.
She's in the hospital.
I thought...
No,
Kojo clarified, his disembodied voice so close.
I meant she's had some trouble. Another seizure. Doctors told me she's okay, but they don't know what brought it on. I thought maybe those pills her mom was giving her. They're running tests. I just figured you ought to know about it.
A seizure?
Yes, that's what I was told.
But she's okay?
She's asking for you. Doctors told her you'd be by to check on her in the morning, when visiting hours start up again.
I'll go now, Matilda said, pushing off the blankets. I have access.
Now, I didn't mean to get you out of bed, and...
Why'd you call me, then?
Matilda didn't mean it in any accusatory way, and she hoped the tone of her voice made that clear. She wasn't sure why she cared if she offended Kojo, someone she barely knew. But she did, and it went beyond just professionalism. There was an emotion attached to her worry. She wanted him to like her, to trust her, to want to call her again.
Okay, she told herself. What's that all about? This isn't just about Ashanique or...
Matilda listened keenly to the silence on the other end as she grabbed a pair of green scrub bottoms from the floor. Kojo cleared his throat.
I was worried about her, he said. Figured you might be too.
Want to meet there?
Kojo paused again.
Been a long night already. I've got a ton of paperwork. Everyone hears about shootings and wonders about the investigations. How the cops follow leads and sort through evidence. No one ever stops to think about all the paperwork. That's just not sexy. Truth is, though, almost every case is broken line by line. We write the reports and find the answers there.
You're right. Doesn't sound sexy.
Drive safe now, Kojo said. I'll talk to you again soon.
Matilda put the cell phone back on the nightstand. She replayed Kojo's last words in her head in a loop. There was something there. She told herself that maybe, after Ashanique was okay, after the girl was safe and in a place where Matilda could really truly understand what was going on in her head, then maybe this thing with Kojo could...
Ashanique needs you. That's it. That's the only thing happening right now.
23 minutes later, Matilda walked into the hospital. She stopped by the nurse's station on the sixth floor and asked the on-call psychiatrist about Ashanique's condition. The psychiatrist wasn't too worried about the seizure. That was the domain of Dr. Olson, the neurologist on deck,
but she had concerns about some of the things Ashanique had been saying. They went beyond post-traumatic stress. The psychiatrist tossed around words like undifferentiated schizophrenia and schizophreniform disorder. Matilda wasn't prepared to call it anything yet. Despite some reservations, the psychiatrist okayed Matilda to look in on the girl. Figured it would help for Ashanique to see a familiar face. The curtains were drawn across the windows to room 623. Inside, the only light emanated from a blinking call button hung over the edge of Ashanique's bed. The girl appeared to be asleep. Matilda closed the door quietly. She considered tiptoeing over to the uncomfortable recliner near the bathroom. She figured she could sleep there until Ashanique woke up. But halfway across the room, Matilda realized that might frighten her. A soft voice called to her from the darkness.
I'm awake.
Ashanique sat up. With her braids undone, her hair spilled out against a propped-up pillow in magnificent wild curls. Ashanique moved her feet out of the way so Matilda could sit on the edge of the hospital bed.
How are you doing?
Matilda asked, sitting down. Ashanique shrugged.
Fine. I heard about the seizure. Must have been scary.
It wasn't. I'm worried about what caused it, though.
Ashanique, do you know what is happening?
It's the memories. All those lives that are coming back.
Like George?
Ashanique nodded. Though it was hard to see the girl's eyes, Matilda felt the weight of her gaze. She shifted and moved farther up on the bed, closer to Ashanique. She needed the girl to know she wasn't going anywhere, that she could be trusted. As Matilda listened to Ashanique's breathing, images from the previous 48 hours flooded her mind. So much had happened. This little girl was in the hospital, and her mother was missing, possibly dead. Clark's throat had been slit by some maniacal killer. Matilda herself had been only minutes away from death. And all of it had started the moment she walked into Ashanique's life.
Did your mother tell you about George? Did she coach you?
Matilda needed to know the truth. Ashanique seemed to sink into her bed. You still don't believe me.
I'm not saying I don't. I just need to understand what it is you're experiencing.
I did some research on George Edwin Ellison. You got all the facts right. All the ones I could verify, and the details were remarkable.
Whatever it is that is going on inside your mind, Ashanique, it makes you very, very special.
It scares me sometimes, Ashanique whispered.
It's not seeing all the lives that came before this one. It's not experiencing them, either. Some of them are really, really horrible, though. It's just that there are too many. Sometimes I feel like I'm going to drown under the weight of all of them.
I'd find that frightening, too.
You had that feeling ever?
Not like that. But I swam when I was in high school, and I once helped save one of my teammates. She'd been bragging about being able to swim the length of the pool, back, and then back again in one breath. Stupid stuff. She tried and almost made it. She sank to the bottom of the deep end, and luckily, I was over there. I pulled her up, and the coach did CPR. She was okay, but afterward, she told us what it felt like. Her head got light, fizzy, like there was soda bubbling around inside, she said. But her body got really heavy. She sank faster than she knew she could. Then it all went black.
Ashanique nodded as she listened to Matilda. It makes me feel like I might go crazy like the others.
Matilda leaned in.
What others, Ashanique?
The girl's hands tightened on the bedsheets.
My mom told me things when she was alive.
Ashanique,
we don't know that. She's gone now,
Ashanique said.
I don't know how I feel it, but I do. It's not so bad, though. Things were getting tough for her. She was really stressed out. She's with the older ones now, with the other numbers.
Matilda propped herself up on her right arm so she had a better view of Ashanik. As she spoke, she ran her fingers along the girl's forearm. Even though it was very light, Ashanik seemed to relax instantly at the touch. That man who attacked us, he said he was looking for number 51. I assume he meant your mom. Do you know what that means? She was 51 of what? Ashanik said, she didn't tell me. She didn't need to. Can you tell me? Clarity. It was called Project Clarity. It was an experiment a long, long time ago. But I can see it in my head. That's what I was drawing, you know? When you saw me in my room, that place in the forest and the snow. I was there, Matilda. I was part of it in a past life. In my mom's life and my grandmother's life. The night doctors did terrible things there. Terrible things. And they'll do them again if they catch me. That's why he's looking for me. The man at the pharmacy? Ashanik nodded. Listen, you're safe here, okay? There are policemen on every floor of this building. They're all here. And I'm here. You don't have to run anymore, Ashanik. You're safe. And I'm not going to leave you, no matter what happens. Ashanik took Matilda's hand and squeezed it tight between her own. Her fingers were warm, and Matilda's were so cold. You heard my mom, Ashanik said. I have to meet someone tonight. I know that's what your mom said, but this person, Childers. Who is Childers? I don't know. Someone who works for Dr. Song. We have to be in the library at the International Museum of Surgical Science tonight. Have you met Dr. Song before? Ashanik looked away, hiding whatever she knew. A moment later, she said, I've never met him, but my mom told me he is the only one who can fix me. Why would you need to be fixed, Ashanik? I already told you. Right now, the past lives that I can see are just a trickle. But my mom told me that more and more will come. Without the pills, they'll overwhelm me. Make me crazy like the others. But even the pills won't stop it all the way. It will get worse and worse as I get older. By the time it's done, I'll be insane. Matilda knew the girl sounded delusional. Her story was the product of a severely ill mother to a daughter who had never known another life outside the topsy-turvy one they inhabited. And yet, the pain, the fear, the profound anxiety in Ashanik's eyes were very real. Matilda knew she had to be careful. When used incorrectly, therapy can be more damaging than a weapon. How will Dr. Song fix you? Ashanik smiled. With a solution. 32. 3:18 a.m., November 15, 2018. University of Chicago Medical, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Henry Olson was dictating when the detective asked to see him. Dr. Olson was old enough to have grandchildren, but he was the proud father of a 7-year-old girl. She'd run him ragged the last few days, between dance recitals and the art classes that his husband Alex insisted on signing her up for, despite the fact that he couldn't take her. Dr. Olson's anger at having to drive across the city in rush hour dissipated the second he saw his daughter's first papier-mâché mask. He mounted it above the fireplace, the proud father of a budding artist. But now there was this impossible case of a girl whose mother had been feeding her cancer medications without any medical oversight. Unreal. Dr. Olson would have asked himself what the world was coming to, but it was actually much improved from when he was a young intern, when it felt like every other child was coming to the ER, abused and abandoned. In the few quiet, alone hours that Dr. Olson had, usually when he was swimming at the rec center, he frequently drifted back to the faces of those broken children. He wished he could gather them up in his arms, give them those precious moments of happiness his daughter so enjoyed.
What can I do for you, Detective?
Dr. Olson leaned back in his office chair and undid his tie. He noticed the clock on the wall behind the detective. It was nearly 3:30 in the morning. Kojo said,
Any updates on Ashanik?
Dr. Olson threaded his fingers behind his head.
She seems like a healthy girl, and considered what she's witnessed, she's doing surprisingly well. But that's not to say I don't have some concerns. First and foremost is the fact that her mother's been dosing her with an experimental cancer medicine, one that has never been properly studied in children and has some serious side effects in adults. The girl's blood sugar is also higher than I'd like. Could mean prediabetes. Could mean something else. We're waiting on additional labs to come back. Any luck on finding the mother?
Still looking. You mentioned side effects from the medication.
There are a whole host of things. Pain, nausea, headaches, blurred vision, anemia, lymphedema, restlessness. But I'm most concerned about potential liver damage. I haven't seen anything to suggest there's an actual problem, though. Why would the mother give her daughter something like this?
Dr. Olson shook his head.
That's the real question, right? Wish I had an answer. You wouldn't believe the things I've seen parents give their children. But I'm sure you've come across just as many horrors.
I honestly have no idea why she'd give the girl Metrochime. But I can tell you that it isn't exactly an easy medicine to come across. It's an experimental cancer drug, developed by a small British pharma company to treat leukemia but stuck in clinical trials. Average time it takes to get pediatric approval on a drug is 13 years. This thing's been around at least that. Funny thing is, the mother had to work hard to track this stuff down. That suggests to me at least that it was more than deliberate. It was calculated. She obviously believed that this drug would help her daughter. Against what? Your guess is as good as mine. Certainly not cancer.
Any of these side effects involving mental disturbances? Seeing things. Hearing things. Schizophrenic-like behaviors.
Dr. Olson frowned.
Not that I'm aware of. But truth is, when a clinical trial is run, nearly every side effect is listed. Someone stubs their toe twice during a research study of a medication, and it'll turn up on the warnings. Half the stuff on there is a sort of reverse placebo effect. People know they're taking a new med, and will assign any negative health condition that arises to it. You enroll someone in a study who fails to mention he gets headaches every afternoon on account of the amount of caffeine he drinks. And guess what? Your drug now has a side effect of causing headaches. That's an oversimplification, but not far from the truth. So yeah, maybe psychological stuff is possible. We haven't done a full eval yet.
What's got you concerned?
Some of the stuff she talked about. Said she hears things? I leave most of that to our psychiatrists. I don't see anything in a neurological sense. No tumors, no apparent injuries. Nothing physical that might cause some of the things you're describing. However, the wheels of medicine sometimes move pretty slowly. I'll have a better sense of things when we get all the test results in.
Dr. Olson ended with his trademark, not much left to talk about smile.
Thanks, Doc, Kojo said. Appreciate it. I'll call you when I know anything more.
Kojo told himself it would be a good idea to check on Ashanik himself. He didn't mind seeing Matilda as well. Kojo knew she was at the hospital. After his wake-up call, she wouldn't have been able to sleep. She was more than just transfixed by Ashanik. He had to admit, the girl had a certain fascination that went beyond the details of the case. Even Dr. Olson had confirmed as much. Kojo took an elevator to the 6th floor, where he flashed his badge to the nurse working the desk. Kojo found the door to Ashanik's room open. He peered inside and saw Matilda sitting on the girl's bed. Ashanik awake smiled and waved.
Thought you had paperwork, Matilda said.
I was in the area, figured I'd stop by. Want to get a cup of coffee?
Matilda turned and looked back at Ashanik.
Ashanik nodded.
I'll be fine. Kojo and Matilda grabbed two cups of watery coffee from the cafeteria. The only people sitting at the tables were a handful of staff. Nurses, medical assistants, and doctors, who talked shop over stale donuts and exceedingly thick slices of banana bread. Drinks in hand, they made their way to a bench in the lobby. Through the floor-to-ceiling windows, they could see a steam vent sending weaving white serpents up into a night sky peppered with stars. The night was frigid and silent.
"You think she's special too, don't you?" Matilda asked Kojo.
"I think she's resilient."
"I mean, the stories."
Kojo nodded. "The past life memories?"
"Yes."
Even harried and exhausted, Matilda was a bright light. Kojo noted the brilliance in her eyes, a brilliance that suggested an unquenchable curiosity and a fierce intellect. He also noticed how incredibly smooth the skin around her neck was. He imagined touching it, but quickly shook the thought loose.
"I'm not a scientist like you," Kojo said. "But my gut tells me there's something more going on here than just a girl telling stories. To be honest with you, thinking about this stuff gives me that sort of overwhelming feeling you get when you think too hard about space. You know, about how it's infinite? How we're these tiny specks in the middle of nothing. You think too hard about that stuff and you feel crazy. I realize that's not a technical term. What about you?"
"I still don't know. If it's true, it flips psychology on its head. If it's not, it means she's some sort of savant. Either way, I can't help but feel
that she's special."
"Yeah."
Kojo shifted, stretching his back. It was a tell, an unconscious shifting of emotion. Matilda knew he was going to ask her something personal.
"I get the research," he said. "I get why you have an interest in Arsenic's case. But there's something more to it, isn't there? This whole thing, the past lives, the idea that you can remember backwards hundreds of years, it speaks to you. I mean, beyond the science of it."
Matilda said, "Is it that obvious?"
"No,"
Kojo replied.
"I just pick up on things.
My mother has Alzheimer's.
Hers was early onset. My grandfather did too. I'm convinced, well, all the genetic science says, I'm likely to develop dementia. I've spent my career, most of it really, trying to find a way to stop the progression of dementia. Seeing it firsthand, watching how someone can be so utterly erased so quickly. I knew since I was in high school that I would make it my mission to find a cure. So I studied chemistry and psychology, and I've been trying to weave the two together. If we can understand the chemistry of how a memory is formed, of how the brain stores those memories, how it retrieves them, then we can figure out how to protect the process, how to fix it when it's falling apart. I have all these notes on the walls of my office. They started out as a way to try and see the big picture. You should see my apartment. Anyway, I thought that maybe immersing myself in it all would help guide that breakthrough."
"And did it?"
"No," Matilda said. "It wound up being a nest of sorts, a way to insulate myself in my own thoughts. I don't think I realized that until now, until Arsenic. I'm so scared that I'm going to lose it all. Lose myself like my mother and grandfather. I'm struggling to write all my thoughts and ideas down as fast as I have them."
"They all worth keeping?"
"Of course not. What happened this morning, it's helped me remember that all this stuff is only important if it truly helps other people too. Why bother solving the riddle of memory if you have no one to remember?"
Matilda's cell phone buzzed. She pulled it from her purse. The screen read, "Tomiko."
"A colleague,"
Matilda said, tucking her phone away. "She probably heard about what happened yesterday morning. Wants to make sure I'm okay."
"Understandable. You had a rough day."
Matilda's cell phone buzzed again.
A text from Tomiko. "Just heard. Oh my God. Please call me, or just stop by."
"Sorry," Matilda said, turning back to Kojo.
Look, you've got stuff to do. I should get going anyway.
Of course. All that paperwork.
Yeah. Kojo smiled. Always the paperwork.
He put out his hand. They shook. Kojo noticed how cool her hand felt. He had the sudden, at the time inexplicable, desire to warm it. The shake lasted a little longer than either of them expected, and ended with an awkward parting. Kojo laughed.
Okay. Okay. I'll be in touch.
Matilda said,
please do.
33. Matilda watched Kojo walk to the elevator. As the doors closed, he looked at her and waved. Matilda replayed their conversation as she walked back upstairs. She worried she wasn't as clear about Ashanik's uniqueness as she'd meant to be. At the same time, she wondered if it mattered. She could tell that Kojo recognized the strange, powerful aura around the girl. It was unmistakable. Reaching Ashanik's floor, Matilda stopped by the doc box, where physicians and nurses gathered to chart and discuss cases. There were a couple of residents charting. She didn't know either of them, and they both looked a good 10 years younger than she was. 4 a.m, and they were running on that superhuman energy that came with being 20 and on the verge of a new career. When Matilda walked in, they seemed surprised to see her.
I heard what happened to Clark. So terrible.
Matilda just nodded. She knew they weren't sympathetic because of the affair. Clark had kept that as hidden as his empathy. But he was her boss. And in a tight-knit university community, the loss of a boss to something as horrible as murder.
No.
Matilda mentally told herself. It was a slang. Was a tragedy. No one could emerge from unscathed. Matilda needed to remain numb. She needed to focus on Ashanik. Matilda took a seat at a computer. As she logged into the system, she wondered if what the girl had was something psychological, possibly a mixture of coaching and untreated illness. Then it was unique, a condition she'd never seen before, let alone read about. If it wasn't, then, well, Matilda knew she couldn't let her mind go there yet. All she knew with any certainty was that Ashanik's case was incredibly complicated. Whatever Janice had gotten into, it was ugly, and the girl desperately needed help to get out of it. Regardless of what the cops uncovered, regardless of whether social services could find the girl a new, safe home, there would be years of therapy required to work through the trauma, not to mention whatever underlying condition was causing the seizures and visions. Matilda opened Ashanik's electronic medical record and asked one of the residents to take a look at the girl's labs. She knew the results weren't off, nothing elevated, nothing weird, but she needed corroboration. There were brain scans as well. The resident only confirmed what Matilda already figured. Analysis of the girl's chart showed nothing physically wrong with her. No tumor, no infections, no nothing.
God damn it. So much for the easy explanation.
Matilda went down the hall to Ashanik's hospital room. She found the girl asleep. As the first beams of daylight softened the air, Ashanik turned, grimaced, and groaned. Matilda walked over, ready with a soothing hand, when her cell phone buzzed again. This time, it was a call from Canada, and not a number she recognized. Matilda answered the phone with a whispered hello as she exited Ashanik's room and stepped into the hallway.
Dr. Deacon? This is Dr. Lane Foss. Did I wake you?
No, I'm awake. Who's this?
Sorry,
Dr. Foss said. His voice had the distinctive speakerphone echo.
I don't know what time zone you're in. I'm one of the curators at the Canadian War Museum. You left a message about a pocket watch belonging to a British First World War soldier named George Ellison.
Oh, yes, I did.
Well, we have the pocket watch in an exhibit here. It's on loan from the Imperial War Museum in Manchester. Did you have a specific question about it?
Matilda leaned against a wall as two nurses passed her. One of them, a former student who had gotten terrible grades, waved, and Matilda nodded back with a smile. She couldn't believe the hospital had hired her.
So, Matilda said into the phone, this is going to sound a little goofy, but is there any chance that there's a smiley face or a drawing carved into the back of the pocket watch?
A smiley face?
Yeah.
Dr. Foss was silent. Matilda worried he was about to hang up. The request did sound ridiculous. But he didn't hang up. She heard a click as he switched off from speaker. His voice was suddenly closer, the phone rustling as he walked.
I'll take a look, he said. I'm right here near the exhibit now. Can I ask what this is in regards to? It is an odd request.
I'm working with a family member of Mr. Ellison. There is apparently a long-standing story that Mr. Ellison carved a face on the back of that watch. I told the family I'd inquire about it. That's the long and short of it.
Well, Dr. Foss said, I'm looking at the pocket watch now and I don't see anything. It's blank on the back. Just a metal case with a... No, there's no inscription of any kind. Guess we can put that family legend to rest.
Matilda glanced into the room at Ashanik. The girl had rolled again in her sleep, covering half her face with the bedsheets as the light poured in. Matilda was convinced the girl wasn't making up the pocket watch story. It was such a strangely specific detail, and Ashanik seemed so confident of it. Still, this little girl had far bigger problems than dealing with a voice inside her head. Her mom had taken investigational cancer drugs, for God's sake. There was a maniac trying to kill her.
Maybe, Matilda thought. It's just best to let this past life stuff go.
As convincing as Ashanik seemed, it isn't doing her any good to rehash it all. The girl needs real help. Not your getting lost in her mother's delirium.
I'm sorry to have bothered you, Dr. Foss, Matilda said.
Thank you.
Hang on.
Foss's voice was distant again.
There's something here, he said. I need to use both hands for a second. Can I call you back in a minute? It'll be just a
minute.
Sure. Dr. Foss hung up before he heard the reply. Matilda stood in the hallway, confused about what was happening, and checking her cell every few seconds for a message or an email. Nothing came. She sighed, leaned over to look again at Ashanik. And that was when her cell buzzed. It was not a phone call, though. It was a video call. Matilda answered, and a video chat window opened on her cell. She saw a desk, blurry with motion for a moment before it stabilized. Dr. Foss's voice came in from off-screen.
Sorry about the delay, he said. This is kind of crazy, but I noticed the back of the pocket watch. The casing had an edge to it. There was a layer of metal on top, a covering, so I...
The image shook again, and Dr. Foss's hand appeared. He was holding a metal circle in his right hand. It was dull bronze.
This was on the back, he said. Sort of a cover, I guess. It was probably done when it was refurbished shortly after the war. I pulled it off. It just kind of snapped off. Anyway, I want you to see this.
Dr. Foss put the metal circle down on the desk and moved the pocket watch into view. The watch appeared quite ordinary, the kind of thing you'd find in the vest pocket of a hip businessman or the back pocket of a grandpa. Dr. Foss turned it over, and Matilda gasped, nearly dropping the cell. Engraved on the back of a pocket watch, faint but unmistakable, was a smiley face. It wasn't the sort of smiley face Matilda was used to seeing. Nothing like the spray-painted ones under overpasses or drawn with Sharpies in bathroom stalls. The head was blocky rather than round. The impression it gave was less of mirth than longing. There was something undeniably haunting about it.
I guess family legend trumps expert opinion,
Dr. Foss said.
I would love to hear more about how you found out about this.
Wow. Thank you, Matilda said, utterly stunned.
You're welcome.
The call ended. Matilda thought she might vomit. 34. 5:38 a.m., November 15, 2018, Lakeshore Gymnasium, Chicago, Illinois. Reid entered the Lakeshore Gym through the revolving doors. He was wearing a baseball cap with three LED lights sewn into the crown. The lights were on. A referral-only athletic center on the city's Gold Coast, Lakeshore was the fifth most exclusive club in the United States. Members endured a five-hour fitness evaluation before they could begin a customized training program in the gym's 150,000-square-foot indoor running track, five heated pools, 12 indoor tennis courts, driving range, and private changing cabanas. Annual membership fees typically ran close to $27,000. Retinal scanners restricted access on each of the gym's five floors. Only 50 members had admittance to the penthouse's private spa. Reid was not a member. But he was likely more familiar with the facility than even its staff. He'd surveilled the place on the few occasions he'd visited. He knew where the cameras were, their models, and how to fool them. The cameras installed in the club couldn't properly process bright LEDs. The one sewn into his cap would conceal his face when anyone reviewed the video feed. He'd look like someone with a gleaming supernova for a head. Reid also knew there was only a single armed security guard on duty. The young woman at the front desk wore a dark suit and had her hair pulled back in a tight ponytail. She was in her early 20s and greeted Reid with a pearlescent smile. He noticed the tiny diamond stud in her left nostril.
Good afternoon, sir. Can I help you?
Dorothy Sykes, Reid said.
The young woman shook her head. I'm sorry. Our membership.
Reid pulled a Bren 10 10mm pistol from the holster under his left arm and shot the woman between the eyes. Blood pollocked the wall behind her, making sure not to get any of her blood on his fingers. Reid kneeled down over her body and carefully pulled her ID badge and then used it to swipe the door behind the desk. The door led to a hallway lined with sitting couches and framed photos of tropical locations, artfully blurred. The security guard came running around the corner, face busy with concern. He barely registered Reid's presence before a slug popped through his chest. The guard hit the lushly carpeted floor, face first. At the end of the hall was an elevator. Using the receptionist's badge, Reid stepped inside and pressed the P button for the penthouse. As the elevator climbed, Reid tucked his sweatpants into his shoes. Then he unzipped and removed his hoodie and carefully folded it before placing it on the floor of the elevator. 32 seconds later, as the elevator chimed and the doors opened, Reid pulled on shatterproof athletic glasses and changed his latex gloves. He stepped out of the elevator into the penthouse. There was a reception area with leather chairs and courtesy health food. Nuts, fruits, and bottles of water. Across the room was a door with a retinal scanner lock. There were two older men lounging about and watching a basketball game on a flat-screen TV. Reid shot them both, one in the head, the other in the shoulder. He grabbed the wounded man and dragged him over to the retinal scanner.
Open the door. Jesus!
Reid pushed the man's head against the scanner. It read his retina, and the door unlocked. Reid shot the man in the temple and let his body slump to the floor. He pulled open the door and stepped into a narrow hallway that led to a glass door, indistinct with steam. Hidden speakers played Chopin. Reid walked slowly, listening carefully. The speakers were playing Chopin's Piano Sonata No. 2. Reid pushed the steam door open and stepped into a large tiled room. Chairs surrounded an opulent jacuzzi, large enough to house an entire football team. Three men and four women sat in the pool. The men were half submerged, their faces red and dripping wet. One of the women rested on the pool's edge, dangling her feet into the tumultuous water. The other, a blonde, was up to her neck, eyes closed. Whatever conversation had been interrupted ceased immediately, as everyone turned bewildered to stare at Raid. He shot all of them but the blonde. Dr. Dorothy Sykes sat frozen in the jacuzzi, her recently reworked breasts bobbing in the froth. She had her eyes closed when the shooting started. The bark of the Bren 10 violently jolted her from a healing daydream about a recent trip to Barbados. Thank Christ the shooting was over quickly. Dorothy opened her eyes to see the bodies of her fellow exclusive members bobbing in front of her. The jacuzzi water went from pink to bright red to deep red.
"That," Dorothy said, "was uncalled for."
"You lied to me,"
Raid said.
"That won't go unpunished."
"I didn't lie to you, Raid. And these people,
rich scumbags,
they had nothing to do with it.
You're losing it, Raid."
Raid closed his eyes and rubbed his right temple.
"I'm not losing anything. Maybe you've forgotten what I am, Doctor. I am not just some errand boy. I'm not a soldier driven by moral duty or blind devotion to an ineffable cause. I am what you made me, a weapon."
"You don't actually think the knife cares about whose throat it slits, do you?" "This was wrong. This won't be an easy mess to clean up."
"None of them are."
Raid stepped closer to the pool and pointed the gun directly at Dorothy's face.
"There's a new machine online. I can be cured."
"Why would you believe 51?
I can tell when someone is lying to me. I'd peel her like a grape. In a situation like that, I've found that people tend to be pretty honest."
Raid raised the Bren 10, leveled it at Dorothy.
"Okay, okay," she said. "Can we talk?"
"Go ahead."
Maybe I could get out first? I mean..."
Dorothy glanced down at the body of one of the murdered men floating beside her. The body spun in circles, buffeted by the jets. He had a Marine Crest tattoo on his left shoulder, faded, the ink diffused under the skin. There was something so unnatural about his flesh in the water. It looked like rubber. Dorothy had seen death before. She'd inflicted it many times, but those times had always been under contained antiseptic circumstances, always rationalized through careful process and design. While in high school at Dover Sacred Heart Academy, she wrote a report on Dracula. A curious girl, encouraged by one of the school's more liberal teachers, she explored the real history behind the vampire mythology. She wrote about Vlad the Impaler, lingering on the more disgusting details, and Elizabeth Bathory, who bathed in the blood of virgins. Writing the paper, Dorothy had gotten an illicit charge, envisioning a nubile countess sitting in a tub of gore. She felt filthy pleasure in the idea and punished herself with 6 Hail Marys. In the jacuzzi, her stomach turned. She needed to get out, and quick.
"Can you please hand me a towel?"
Raid walked over to a shelving unit and tossed a towel to Dorothy. She stepped out of the pool and wrapped the towel around her chest. Her skin glistened with pink water and tiny crimson bubbles.
"I didn't lie, Raid," Dorothy said.
As she sat in a lounge chair, Raid leaned and crouched across from her, rolling his neck, working out a kink.
"There is a second machine, but,"
Dorothy said,
"but we've only had some early successes with it with primates. All of our tests with human subjects failed. I didn't want to tell you until we'd perfected the procedure, until the accelerator was ready."
"What's the holdup?"
"We're getting complex DNA damage. Can't repair it easily."
"Why? Homologous recombination isn't working?"
"No, it is, but it's inconsistent."
"So you mix it up.
Try microhomology mediated end joining." "We have. We think it's on the machinery end."
"I don't understand, Dr. Sykes," Raid said.
I gave you the solution. We ran it, and there are still problems.
What problems?
Dorothy had spent the last 2 days in meetings, sometimes meetings within meetings, where she joined a video conference call while in a departmental working group. She prided herself on being the leader, on being able to switch mental gears with surprising ease. Mostly, she liked how her quick thinking surprised people at the table or on the other end of the camera. There was a process to thinking in three dimensions, that's what she dubbed the skill, and it involved focusing on the salient details first, like speed reading. Dorothy had taught herself how to pick out the imperative stuff and abandon the clutter in only a few seconds. Thinking in three dimensions was a skill, and one that made leaders look good. But Dorothy knew that being a leader also meant looking like a leader, staying fit, staying strong. Talking like you mean everything you say, regardless of whether you actually did.
It's rather complicated, Dorothy said.
Don't belittle me. I have a gun.
Of course, Dorothy said, as she stood and grabbed another towel from the shelf.
We can go to the facility now, if you'd like. It's probably best if you saw it all firsthand. You can see how the solution fits in for yourself and come to your own conclusions.
Dorothy looked to Raid for an answer.
Fine, Raid said. Hurry.
35. 7:13 a.m., November 15, 2018. Jesse Brown, VA Medical Center, Chicago, Illinois. Raid always hated being in hospitals, yet it seemed a particularly cruel twist of fate that he'd ended up spending all his childhood under medical supervision and much of his adulthood walking down the quiet halls, passing through the antiseptic labs, and eating the near-tasteless cafeteria food of countless hospitals. He could live with the food, the sterile environment. It was the patients that made his skin crawl. Hospitals traded in an illusion of cleanliness, when in fact, they were bastions of unchecked disease. Following Dorothy down a narrow hallway, he was keenly aware of everyone that passed him, every opportunity for infection. While Dr. Sykes was dressed in business attire and a lab coat, with a stethoscope around her neck, Rabe was garbed in a new tracksuit and hoodie. Per usual, he was wearing latex gloves, but he'd also pulled shoe covers over his sneakers and had a blue carbon filter mask. As Rabe feared, the hospital was crowded with the usual worrisome assortment. Harried doctors scrambling to get from room to room, charts and clipboards in hand, jaded nurses in comfortable shoes, and worse, waiting rooms filled with Vietnam-era, bearded and scraggly men, with their wives, and the younger, straight-laced vets, many missing limbs. Dorothy navigated the crowds carefully, weaving through doors she unlocked with a passkey on a lanyard, twirling the Aurora fountain pen in her hand. Raid followed closely behind, ignoring the disabled, the ill, and the angry. He felt like Lucifer among hell's teeming masses. An angel, albeit a rouge one, thrown down with the fetid hordes. He didn't walk past them so much as he walked above them. Poor pieces of shit were so mired in their animal selves that they didn't even bother to look up at him as he passed.
This way, Dorothy said.
Dorothy stopped at a service elevator. Her passkey worked here as well, allowing them to access the hospital's private sixth floor. When the elevator arrived, Raid stepped inside first, eager to get away from the crowds. When the doors opened again, Raid followed Dorothy down an empty corridor to a double door. The large room behind the doors felt like a factory. There were tracks on the floor and large blocks of machinery sitting about, all of them linked together by miles of wire, cable, and hawsers. People in scrubs and smocks milled about, comparing notes on tablets. Dorothy crossed the room to a linear particle accelerator, a LINAC machine. It resembled an MRI on steroids. Its cyclopean eye stared down from the ceiling like the tail end of a telescope.
Dr. Sykes?
One of the people at the back of the room walked over. He had a mess of curly hair and large framed glasses. His badge read, Anno.
The machine is calibrated, he said. Still having trouble with the flattening filters, but...
This is a cannon, not a scalpel. We agree on that?
Yes.
Where is the patient?
Anno pointed with his chin to a drooling and shaved man in a wheelchair. Two nurses stood beside him. They wore full-face guards and elbow-length rubber gloves. Raid noticed the gloves were neoprene, black and shiny. There was something undeniably sexy about them. Raid typically used the nitrile powder-free gloves, the purple kind, because they were easy to find and comfortable. But he made a mental note to ask the nurses where they got the neoprene ones. The man in the wheelchair had purple bags under his eyes, heavy with fluid. Raid guessed the man hadn't slept in a while. He was desperately near death.
Begin,
Dorothy told Anno. Anno in turn signaled the nurses. They wheeled the ill man to a rough X marked by duct tape beneath the lens of the Linac machine. The man sat slumped there, too sick to even look up at the equipment towering over him. Anno handed Dorothy a tablet. She held it so Raid could see the screen.
This is Mr. Taylor Heyerdahl, aged 56, Dorothy said. He is of average intelligence and has undergone several days of thought reform treatments, including electroshock and hourly regimen doses of temazepam and scopolamine. As you can see from his readings, there is still significant, though dulled, electrical activity in the frontal striatal circuitry and the hippocampus. He's exactly where we've been stuck for the past 20 years. If the solution works, we'll see that neural activity skip a beat before we reset it.
Anno signaled the team manning a computer back on the far side of the room. The Linac clanked to life. The machine rattled and knocked like a metal poltergeist. The beams emanating from its lens were invisible, but their effect on Mr. Taylor Heyerdahl was not. He spasmed in his chair and spat as his tongue protruded from his mouth. The sound he made was inhuman. All the blood vessels in his eyes popped simultaneously, painting his sclera bright red, before he died of a massive heart attack. With the test over, the Linac machine instantly fell silent. Dorothy turned to Raid and shrugged.
51 lied to you to protect her daughter.
The solution?
It's incorrect.
Very clever, but incorrect.
Maybe she changed one number. Maybe she changed 10. What she provided us looked like it broke the cipher, but it didn't. It just gave us what looked like answers.
I looked into her eyes. She wasn't hiding anything.
She tricked you. Or she remembered it wrong.
Raid pulled the Bren 10 from the back of his pants and shot Anno in the chest. Anno fell backward, his face registering nothing. His tablet shattered on the floor. Tech scrambled, ducking for cover. Raid tracked them with the barrel of the gun as Dorothy approached him, hands raised, desperate.
Raid, please, you can't just...
Say that again.
Dorothy's face tightened, but she relented.
Please, Raid, stop this.
The best and the brightest, Raid spat. You love to tell me how you have to turn away every genius who comes to your door to work on this project. You're telling me none of these people can solve the problem? How many decades has this organization spent spinning its wheels and grinding gears? I'm beginning to think that Dr. Tyrio was smarter than all of you combined.
What do you want me to tell you?
Dorothy stepped in front of Raid. He pushed the gun to her chin. Dorothy narrowed her eyes. She was brave. Not like the Texan scientist who scattered across the lab at the sound of a single gunshot. Raid respected that about her. Willing to die for a cause.
It isn't about intelligence, Dorothy said. It's about technology.
We're light years more advanced now. Don't bullshit me.
No, you're right, Dorothy said.
And that's exactly the problem.
The math Dr. Tyrio was doing was old school, artisanal,
everything was so compartmentalized back then. It's a wonder we even know the answers we do. Over the past 40 years, we've broken only 2 of the ciphers she used for her journals, and none of those addressed the genetic issues we need answered. So you work backward. You reverse engineer it. What I'm saying is, we might know some of the answers, but the problem is, we don't know what question she was asking. We've managed through brute force to develop algorithms that buffer the areas. Raid eased his finger from the trigger. Nodding, Dorothy reached up and carefully pulled the gun from her chin. You see, the machine is real, she said. It functions. We can prime subjects with targeted treatments to block CRH receptors before hitting the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus. The beam is strong, but we can't get the wavelength right. As you can clearly see, Mr. Heyerdahl's brain was effectively fried. You are right. All these brilliant people can't solve this. Not like you can. You got us close with 51, but for whatever reason, it didn't work. If you want to cure yourself and move this research forward, then I need you to get the girl. She isn't like her mother. The memories will be fresh. Her brain is malleable. Find her, and we can wrench the real solution from her. Raid tucked the Bren 10 away, and Dorothy visibly relaxed. Fine, he said. But the leash comes off. Raid, I'm on my own. I cannot allow you to continue. This. Dorothy motioned back to Anno's corpse and the widening pool of blood coagulating under him. Cleaning up your mess at the gym was more than enough. I'm not sure the city of Chicago will buy another crazed mass shooter, especially one who works for Fortune 500. My God, Raid, I have to frame one of our investors. Do you know how bad that looks? And now this, a research scientist.
He killed himself, Raid said, walking away. Happens all the time.
36. 8:52 a.m., November 15, 2018. University of Chicago, Center for Integrative Neuroscience, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Tomiko Kadri opened her office door to find Matilda and a young African-American girl waiting for her. She looked taken aback, but considering everything that had happened over the past 24 hours, Matilda was sure she'd understand. While she wasn't a close friend, Tomiko was kind and respectful. Despite the fact that they didn't always see eye to eye on research, Tomiko was convinced there might actually be a biological basis for the inheritance of memory. They bonded over a love of loud music, bad men, and red wine. Tomiko, Matilda said, standing up. Sorry to bust in like this.
It's okay. I called you, remember? Are you okay?
They hugged. The warmth felt good. It was crazy, Matilda thought, how a simple touch, just skin-to-skin contact, could instantly relax her. You heard about Clark.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
This thing has been, I don't even know how to describe it. Roller coaster, earthquake, nothing really fits. And it's not over. There are people after, well, we're just trying to get our footing again, is all.
People after you? This about Clark's murder?
Matilda nodded.
Jesus, Matilda, have you been to the police? You shouldn't.
We've talked to the police. There's a detective helping us out. Kojo something. I don't recall his last name. We're safe. We're okay now. Tomiko didn't look especially convinced. She turned to Ashanik.
And who are you?
The girl gave a forced smile.
My name is Ashanik Walters.
Walters?
Yes, ma'am.
Tomiko nodded before she hung up her purse and settled into her desk chair. She seemed a bit stiff, a bit formal.
Matilda knew Tomiko and her ex-husband had recently got into it over alimony payments. She figured things had gotten worse. Tomiko turned to Matilda.
So how can I help?
I don't know how to say this without it sounding as insane as, well, as it is, but I'm convinced that Ashanik has the ability to recall past lives. Tomiko looked over at Ashanik.
Okay, she said. We've run labs and scans, Matilda said. Everything comes back negative. Every psych battery comes back normal.
Ashanik isn't suffering from paranoid delusions or psychosis. And every historical detail, even the most impossible, has proven true. You have to trust me on this. She is remembering lives and experiences she can't possibly know about.
Okay. Well then, we should discuss our options. Tests reveal nothing?
So far. Tomiko leaned back in her chair.
All right. Let's just talk about this. As you know, there have been some fringe theories about how this past life thing could work. Engrams, the lateral interpositus nucleus, Purkinje neurons. But I haven't studied them all in depth. Could be a matter of genetic enhancers. Sometimes a mutated gene can intensify the phenotypes caused by another gene. That results in stunning effects. In labs, they've been able to create animals immune to certain neurodegenerative diseases, or use the mutated genes to increase muscle mass, and its effect gets stronger as it's passed down. With each successive generation, it can take on new and more powerful properties. Relatively radical stuff.
Matilda nodded, understanding, but she wondered how much, if any, Ashanik caught. She looked over at the girl. Ashanik seemed anxious to go. Tomiko was just getting started, however, clearly intrigued and excited by the concepts Matilda's visit had sparked.
The most logical avenue for the transfer of memories, however, is something called the Morris hypothesis. It suggests that memories can be stored genetically and inherited from parent to child. Are you familiar with the planarian studies in the late 1950s?
Matilda said. No. I might have learned about it in college.
It's pretty memorable.
A lot of college was kind of a blur, frankly. First time away from home. Matilda glanced at Ashanik, hoping the girl didn't get where she was going. Ashanik said,
I don't get what either of you are talking about. Okay. Well, quick lecture then.
Tomiko grinned.
There was a researcher studying these tiny aquatic worms called planarians. They sound gross, but they're kind of cute. They have little goofy eyes. Anyway, planarians have the amazing ability to regrow their bodies. If you take one and you cut off its head, it becomes two planarians. The head grows a new body, and the body grows a new head. The researcher wanted to look at memory with planarians, and he ran this experiment where he taught some planarians how to navigate a maze. Then, he put those planarians in a blender.
Nasty, I know.
And fed their bodies to planarians that had never been in the maze. And guess what happened? They threw up,
Ashanik joked. Tomiko laughed.
No, she continued. They knew how to navigate the maze. Crazy, right? The finding was shocking. It suggested that memory could be stored in the body and transferred. Alas, no scientists were able to replicate the experiment, so it was dismissed and forgotten. But what you're suggesting is that there's a kernel of truth to the planarian idea, that the Morris hypothesis is correct, and memories can be transferred. The only way for us to find out is to run some tests. I'd be looking for crazy electrical stuff going on in the hippocampus. Maybe signs of expanding neural networking and, well, something we've never actually seen before.
Can you do these tests here?
Yes, but ideally we do genetic studies with multiple generations of Ashanik's family. That would give us a clearer picture.
I'm the only one left, Ashanik said.
I'm sorry to hear that, Tomiko replied.
Well then, we'll just have to see what's going on in your head and make deductions based on that information. What are the things you're remembering? Can you tell me some of the specifics?
A soldier dying in World War I, Ashanik said. His name was George Edwin Ellison.
Okay. Anyone else?
Dozens more.
All sorts of people throughout history. Like a boy who hunts a tiger in the jungle. There are people, doctors like you, at this military base in the forest.
I see that a lot.
In fact, I think you look like someone who was there.
Tomiko smiles, turns to Matilda.
I don't know. You're clearly convinced something is going on. I get that, and I respect your judgment. So we'll do the tests. We'll do electrical stimulation on some particular parts of the hippocampus, while running a few standard visual programs, and see what comes back. That sound good?
Matilda nodded and looked back at Ashanik.
I guess, the girl said, staring hard at Tomiko.
By the way, why now?
Tomiko asked, as she gathered up some papers.
Why would these past life memories suddenly just appear 2 days ago?
Ashanik looked down at her lap.
My mom said because of my period.
Your mom knew about this condition?
Yes. She had it too.
One last thing, Tomiko said, standing. If the Morris hypothesis is correct, and memory can be inherited alongside genes, then how is it that Ashanik can remember the last moment of George Edwin Ellison's life? She claims to have seen his death, but he never handed down those specific memories. He died with them.
I experienced it, Ashanik said. I felt it.
And I don't know how that'd be possible, honestly. Even if we accept that memory can be transferred, and for whatever reason, Ashanik has been able to activate them, she's talking about memories she can't have. We can't know for sure, of course, but these inherited memories should only go up to the birth of the next generation, when the genes bifurcated. So Ashanik should only have her mother's memories up until her own birth.
Ashanik said,
I don't know how it works, but I know what I see.
Well then, Tomiko said, grabbing her purse. Let's go to the lab.
37. 9:39 a.m., November 15, 2018, West Garfield Park, Chicago, Illinois.
Tell me the story of the girl again.
Brandon sat at the kitchen island and kicked the cabinet underneath. When Kojo first remodeled the kitchen, Brandon would sit there and kick the newly painted wood with his shoes, scuffing the paint within seconds. Even though Kojo realized that few, if any, people would be looking at the cabinet doors beneath the island, the thought of those scuff marks drove him crazy. He couldn't convince Brandon to stop the kicking, either. Dr. Landau, the boy's doctor, suggested it might be a repetitive behavior, an unconscious way to cope. So Kojo got his son some soft slippers, the kind with little stuffed animal heads on the front. His were teddy bears. So Brandon's feet brushed against the cabinet doors. The sound was soft, like wind rustling leaves. Kojo actually liked the sound of it. He was making eggs and toast, Brandon's favorite. Kojo tore a hole in the center of the bread and cracked the egg inside. He cooked them over easy. Brandon loved cutting into the egg and seeing the yolk soak into the bread. He watched Kojo cook, legs pumping madly under the island.
Story time, Brandon said. The one with the octopus.
Kojo frequently told Brandon stories. It wasn't his thing. His tales were stilted and amateurish. Constance had been great at coming up with stories when Brandon was little. She'd just make them up off the top of her head. The one about a giant who uses a tree as a toothbrush. The one about the little girl who finds a hidden world inside a gleaming white cube. But Kojo couldn't. When Kojo winged it, his stream of consciousness stories automatically became work stories. they'd end right there. Cut off before they became too unnerving. Like the one about the veinless junkie who got pregnant, so she could shoot up in the veins in her engorged breasts. Or the one about the pimp who put out a cigarette on one of his girl's eyes. Not stories a child or anyone, for that matter, needs to hear. So instead, Kojo told Brandon about Ashanique.
Her special power is her memory, he said, as he flipped the egg and toast. She has this crazy ability to remember the lives of all sorts of interesting people. People from history like kings and queens and soldiers. Like she's got all the books in her head.
Exactly,
Kojo nodded.
That's actually totally right. She's a special person, like me.
Kojo looked up from the stovetop. Brandon gave his infectious smile, the smile he used on everyone he could. The woman who packed their groceries at the corner store called it the smile of a flirt. Ophelia said it was Brandon's purest expression.
You certainly are, Kojo said. You're why I get up in the morning. I want to make the world a better place for you. I want everyone out there to see you the same way I see you. A strong, brilliant, beautiful boy who believes he can accomplish anything.
Kojo glanced at the clock over the fridge. Ophelia's running late. 15 minutes behind already. He walked through the various things he needed to take care of. The pending cases, the open investigations, all those lost souls, the bodies on ice. He needed to hit the grocery store, too. They'd been out of milk for 3 days, and there was one roll of toilet paper between two bathrooms. And now again, Ophelia was late.
Couldn't she at least pick up one thing on her way over? Does she notice we're running low on milk and toilet paper? Good Lord.
Ophelia will be here soon, Kojo said. I need to finish getting ready.
We should have another mommy.
What?
Another mommy would help you.
Kojo's cell phone rattled the counter, just as the front door unlocked and opened. Ophelia walked into the house with a grocery bag.
Sorry I'm late, she said, closing the door. I just stopped by the market to grab some milk. I noticed you were running low. A few supplies as well.
Brandon jumped down from his counter and ran over to see her. Ophelia laughed as she put down the bag and they hugged. Kojo smiled to her and waved as he entered his cell. His boss, Chief Witkower, was on the other end.
You coming in today?
Yeah, just a late start.
Ophelia walked into the kitchen beside Brandon. He was holding her hand. Cell at his ear, Kojo mouthed,
"Thank you,"
to Ophelia, as she started putting away the groceries. She could have been Brandon's grandmother. In her mid-60s, Ophelia wore a long, colorful skirt and a short-sleeved top. Though she'd been in the States a few years, she dressed as though she were going to work in Accra. Chief Witkower cleared his throat.
"Feds are here."
"Why?"
"Janice Walters' case,"
Witkower said.
"That doesn't make any..."
"It does when you find out who Miss Walters really is,"